Hey, welcome back to the CCWSA podcast. I'm Mike Darter in Oklahoma City.
Stan Campbell standing by his side and to the end.
What's going on, Stan? What's the latest?
The latest is, you know what? Things are starting to loosen up here in Oklahoma, several states across the nation. Still be mindful of your distancing and stuff like that. But, you know, what I really like about the distancing, you know, I talked about this before, but is the fact that it really makes you aware now of people versus keeping your head down. You're really being aware of people now, and as concealed carriers, you always got to do that. So that's one good thing that's going to come out of this. People will pay attention to others.
Yeah, I think for a time. I don't like the word social distancing.
What do you like, Michael? What you
want to call it? I like physical distancing. I like the word physical distancing, but the word social distancing has a very, I don't know, almost like an evil context to me. It really does. I mean, it's just, I just don't like the word social
distancing. That's because you're a social butterfly. You are Mike Darter, the party starter. And I understand that.
Yeah.
So you're the sun and I am the sky. That's why I got all this on this
physical
color.
Distancing. Yeah, I think it's true. I've yet to determine, you know, how we are here and really people everywhere, how quick they forget about things. You know, I mean, it happens all the time. I think that, you know, we'll get back to a normal at some point. but it is good to, you know, I think situational awareness probably has picked up, you know, a little bit with people, which is good.
Yep.
But anything else going on? What's Mama Mona?
You know, Mama
to?
Mona, she's still hanging at the house. You know, she's not going too far. She's got a couple of stores she'll make it to. It was Mother's Day, so my daughter did take her to a restaurant because they eased up enough for her just to, and it was like wide open. There's not that many people.
Well, we went the other day to have brunch Sunday, and it was packed.
It was packed.
I was surprised. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't like super surprised, but I thought, you know, most places are easing back in like 25%, or it was pretty packed.
That was about 90%.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's still good. You just got to be aware of people. The folks working there still wearing masks and gloves, which is, I'm fine with that. I don't want to mess with my food that coughs and crap anyway. Just keep your little germs to yourself beyond this virus. But I'm good with that. I mean, it wasn't bad. We had a good time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think things are, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the upcoming months. I can't wait to start to travel again. I'm really missing New York City, man.
I'm missing New York, too.
Man,
we got a lot of new friends in New York, but New York is awesome.
Oh, man, New York is just, there's no city like it. And
yeah, but you're going somewhere different coming up, aren't you? Where are you going next?
I don't know. You know, I was supposed to go to, I was looking at Patagonia this summer to go lead.
Tell
a
the
tour.
People where that is.
Patagonia? Uh-huh. It's like Argentina-Chilean border.
Nice. Down.
But Patagonia's, you know, amazing landscapes. The mountains are like straight up. I've always wanted to go to Patagonia. And I had an opportunity to go this summer to lead a tour, a small tour, kind of a scout trip to Patagonia for pumas. And in June, July, that's their winter. So it's pretty harsh winters, but it's really good, great landscape opportunities for photography, but also for the pumas. So, but I don't know. I don't know if it's going to happen or not.
So, if you don't do that, you're going to head down and take some pictures of some sharks, right?
Yeah, I'd like to go back to Cabo. Yeah. Just talking about taking my daughters to Cabo.
That'd be awesome.
But yeah, like I said, we'll have to see what opens up.
Yes, sir.
So,
well, speaking of opening up, we're going to open up the show with our guest today is Sean Vincent, one of our content providers. And, I mean, he just really just a wealth of knowledge. I love what he does for our members in reference to the articles and stuff that he writes, the podcast that he does with Don West.
I think really what we over the years, because we've had a great relationship with Sean. It really when we first met Don, when we got Don. And I think I always still say that the articles that they're working on are really the meat and potatoes of what we can offer.
Absolutely.
What we put on our website. And this is not just for members. This is for anybody. So anybody who thinks you know, even thinking about having a firearm should really be reading these articles before you even get a firearm. And if you have a firearm, especially if you carry, you really need to be reading these articles, because these articles, like I said, they're meat and potatoes of our whole thing. We talk about people mitigating their own risk, mm-hmm. Sean, and this is the best stuff to, you know, really, to, we talk about a lot about, we talk a lot about mental imagery, mm-hmm. visualization and stuff. These articles are the best source for these scenario situational type things to think about, because they actually happened.
That's right.
And we actually have an outcome. So, Sean, thanks for doing this. You've been doing this for, what, 3-4 years with us now, maybe longer than that.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
I'm in COVID land, so I can't remember time anymore.
Yeah, time.
But I got a lot of... No, it's interesting is, you know, years ago, before I joined you guys, you know, I was involved in a number of high profile self-defense cases from the defender's side, from the defense mm-hmm. team's side. And then we had an opportunity to start commenting on other high profile self-defense cases. And I thought back then, you know, I'm going to keep track of these, because sometimes they take a couple of years to go through the system, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes what comes out in court is way different from what you thought happened from just the news up front. You know, I'm going to watch these and look for themes in those. Mm-hmm. And so I had kept track of about 9 cases that I was watching over the years. And then that's when Don started working with you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to me with the opportunity. I think he told you guys about me. And he said, I don't know what you think about this, but here's Cease to Be Safe. Here's what they do. And here's what they're looking for. And I thought, you know, I think that would be a great idea, because if we do our job right and we show real life scenarios where most of these people, these defenders that we write about mm-hmm. who make some mistakes in their self-defense, they're inherently good people.
Yes.
They're law abiding people. These aren't criminals out there. These aren't murderers looking to go kill someone. They're people who made some tactical mistakes, maybe made some emotional mistakes. Mm-hmm. And it breaks my heart that somebody died.
Yes.
And it also breaks my heart that somebody who's a good person is now labeled a murderer and mm-hmm. their lives are destroyed. Their families are turned upside down. So I told Don, I said, if we can illustrate these lessons and save, you know, somebody's life,
yes,
maybe who didn't deserve to have it saved, but save it anyway, and then preserve somebody's liberty mm-hmm. and their future, then it'll be worthwhile. And I think, yeah, I think we're on our way. So
absolutely. And before we get too deep into that, because we do want to break that down, if you would, Sean, you know, I mean, there's some things that we don't know about you.
Sure.
Tell us about, you know, your journey, you know, into becoming, you know, the amazing writer that you are today.
You know, it's funny. Is in college, I decided to be an English major.
Okay.
And I was working full time. It took me like 11, 12 years to get through my 4-year degree. And I remember, I graduated with an associate's degree, and I read at the time in Florida back in the 90s that like the average starting salary for someone with an associate's degree was $26,000.
Uh-huh.
But then if you go back to school for 2 more years, Stan, and get an English degree,
yes,
it goes down. So inspired by that, I pursued my heart. And while I was, you know, in wholesale distribution during the day, I got an English degree at night. So I'm fascinated by stories, storytelling, and what you can learn. You know, I'm kind of a book nerd every once in a while.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I like to write. And then I was in communications and marketing for years, had my own little business, kind of followed the internet as that was coming up, and got into helping people communicate with social media when that became a thing. And then the whole recession happened. My business got turned upside down, and by a strange series of coincidences, a friend of mine in Rotary got a real high profile self-defense case. I call it the famous case. It was on all the TV shows.
Yes.
And I was involved with that. I never considered law as anything I was remotely interested in, but I felt passionately about her case. I was fascinated by the court system, but even more so, I was fascinated by how much misinformation there was out about that case. And what really is true and what do we know and what don't we know. And Stan, something you said earlier, I heard you say that, you know, who tells the best story sometimes wins. And that really focused me on the power of, yeah, I wanted to be the one who could tell that best story.
Correct.
And so that's what got me interested in telling stories, especially from this legal point of view. So there you go. Storytelling and how I got into legal stuff there in one shot. So out of that case, I was invited, you know, I had the opportunity to do some commentary on other cases, like the Michael Dunn case, and then got hired by an indigent defense organization to help them handle high profile cases. And, you know, I do jury selection stuff. So training up a team to help do social media research when you have a murder case.
That's awesome.
So then there you go. Now I do a lot of plaintiffs work. I work for a lot of, you know, folks who have been, families lost somebody killed in a terrible accident or catastrophically injured, and that's storytelling too. So I'm all up in the legal industry now. Fake lawyer. I'm a fake lawyer. Like
That's
bull.
right. And then in the way that we used you for the Maddox case, have you ever done anything like that before during jury selection?
Oh, sure. I have a whole team of folks. We do that very frequently where we get we get a panel. It's like they call it voir dire,
Yes.
jury selection process, and
Yes.
we know who's on that panel. And so I have a team. You can never do it just by yourself. It's too much work too fast, right? We have a
Yes.
team. We go online and we find out everything that we can that's publicly available about those prospective jurors, and then the lawyers can use that to help inform their impressions. And you know, one some of the times where that's most valuable is what do you know that the
Yeah,
other
that
side doesn't
doesn't
know,
know, yeah.
That's right.
right? And we knew that the foreman in that jury was somebody who was real Second Amendment, you know, was thoughtful about self-defense. So we didn't ask him any questions about self-defense. We already knew what we wanted to know, and
That's
anything he was
right.
going to tell us, the other side wouldn't like, and they didn't think to ask. So we had a real advantage there.
You know what's interesting, sorry, Mike,
Yeah,
what's
good.
interesting, what's like when I went through my federal lawsuit on the from the police department on a use of force, trumped up cases, of course.
Well, I
But
wouldn't expect
excessive
anything.
use of force for me, I had to sit through that process as well. And we sat there and I had, as the defendant in this case, had the opportunity with my lawyers to help pick and choose the jury. And I swear to you, I mean, our first jury, if we didn't have that mistrial, I would not have had such a success. The mistrial, of course, because of a big
The
boom
bomb.
called the bombing of Oklahoma City. But but the second jurors, set of jurors were a little bit more friendly in reference to police and such, because there's a lot of people just hated the police, and we still had to have them on.
Yeah.
So it's kind of crazy when you get into that situation where it's not only important to be to tell the best story, but you also have to set up the play, the players. In this particular case, the jurors, you have to set up what will be most likely in your favor.
And know what's really important about that in our context, right? Is we all feel pretty much the same about the Second Amendment, the right to carry, right to bear arms. We can be in our bubble. We forget that not everybody feels that way. We forget that it's controversial for a lot of folks. And you don't get the, just like you had some folks who didn't like the police who got on your panel, right? You don't pick who you want for the jury. You deselect the ones that you most can't
Absolutely.
live with.
Absolutely.
And you're stuck with the rest. And
Yes.
so in Florida, we pick a lot of six juror panels. Rest of the country, mostly 12 folks, right? And so you know that some of those people are going to feel very differently about guns and self-defense than you do. And you got to remember, as a concealed carrier, that you know they always say it's better to be judged by 12 than carried by six, right? Yeah, but think about who those 12. You're gonna get the crazy cat lady from down the street with the Elizabeth Warren sign. She's gonna be on that jury, maybe,
That's
if
right.
you can't get her off,
Yeah.
and you're gonna have your behavior has to be justified to everybody, you know.
And that process is during voir dire, correct?
That's right.
That
Depending on
you.
where you're from, voir dire or voir dire, if you're from the south.
Voir dire. And is that, is there, are there any other? Any other times do you work with the defense panel on that, or is it specifically during?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, so I do a lot of theme and theory stuff, mm-hmm. right? So it's, in the end, we have to, now we, you pick your audience, who you're going to be telling your story to, and then now what's the story that we're going to tell? Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a theme and a theory to every case. Mm-hmm. And I legally, I kind of explain it like this, like, you know, the theory of spaghetti dinner is pasta plus hot water plus sauce equals spaghetti, right? Mm-hmm. But I found this great old photograph of Kurt Douglas and Sophia Loren, black and white, eating pasta together, mm-hmm. right? And they got a Chianti with in the Fiasco, and she's all buxom. They're these movie stars, right, eating this pasta, getting drunk together, and it's all fabulous. That's a whole different spaghetti dinner than one with, like, a little two-year-old throwing noodles all over, right? So you can have the same theory of a case, but the theme, the story that you tell, can be radically different. So, yeah, so I work to help develop what's that story that we're going to tell. And, you know, we've done mock jury panels where, to your point, Stan, you'll make the same presentation to, say, 24 people, split them up into two groups and let them deliberate individually. And you can have one group of 12 saw the same thing as the other group, come to radically different conclusions.
Well, that's just the way of the world. You know, I was actually talking with somebody recently about what's going on now with COVID-19. And you can, the news that is being delivered, you can have, you know, two groups of people and they see it totally different ways. I mean, you look at masks, for example, you know, there's two totally different thought processes on that.
And if you get in somebody's face about either wearing a mask or not wearing a mask, you are inviting a heated argument.
Oh yeah. I mean,
People are getting shot for it already.
Oh yeah. It's coming to that. And it's not, and this, the second thing that the main thing we were talking about when we were talking about this was that it was not based on fact. Nothing is based on facts. It's based on personal opinions and ideology, and I think for a group of people, for part of the people, it is based on facts. Mm. But then for another group of the people, and we actually referenced Michael Brown case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
You know, even when the facts came out, if people didn't like those facts, they disregarded those facts and then went back to their personal opinion.
So, well, it's interesting, Mike. So in a legal venue, mm-hmm. right, there's a thing called, you can have facts in dispute.
Yeah.
Right? You bring in a piece of evidence. The evidence is a fact. But do you believe that? Mm-hmm. And you can have two facts that contradict each other. And in our personal lives, we encounter that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So in a court of law, we're going to ask a jury. The judge will tell them at the end, you know, judge everyone's testimony. You can believe some things, you can disbelieve other things. You decide what credibility to assign to it, and then you decide. And Stan, we were talking before about how, you know, you can't know unless you were there.
Yes.
Right? But none of us were there.
Correct.
And if you want to get nerdy for a minute, philosophical, I have this concept that I call the unknowable truth. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, and was it really, what was in that person's heart when they pulled the trigger in a self-defense case? Was it malice or was it fear? And that makes all the difference, right? Yes. But we can never know that. And if you think about your life, what can you really know? You know, is there a God? Does your wife love you? Is coffee good for you or bad for you? You know, like we don't know these things. So what we have to do in order to survive as people, we have to come up with a way to determine how much do we care, and if we're forced to care and have to make a decision upon it, how do we base that decision? And I find that people will use, like, first of all, what matches my life experience?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What does, you know, who are the big influences in your life, and what do they think? Like, what does my dad think?
Yeah.
What does my wife think? What does my pastor think? Right? Yeah. What, you know, what squares with my religious philosophy or my my political identification, right?
Yes.
So we run it through, I call it authentication, all these different processes until I think we get about 70% sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll just say, okay, I'm going to believe this thing.
Yeah.
And then once you've gone through that process, you've done that work, it takes a whole lot for you to think, you know what, I better go back and check my foundations.
Yeah.
Was I wrong about my dad? Am I wrong about God? Am I wrong about my politics? And that people don't want to have that conversation.
You know, and a lot of that too, Sean, is that a lot of people, you know, they just absolutely don't want to accept defeat at all. And I'm talking about, you know, your position, your beliefs, all of that stuff. We all in this room and you, we can just go, the way I think is really the best way, you know, what he thinks and Justin and my son over there is bull crap. What I think is the right way. And then on the flip side of that, all of us are also trained through entertaining media, and I'm talking about like movies and such and television shows.
Yeah.
They teach us and they manipulate us and they train us to accept an entertaining lie versus the truth. Because you can have one person do a documentary on the same incident, another person do a different perspective on the same incident. And in the way that they shoot it, it's like they shoot these things to move you emotionally. And that's really what happens with all of these cases as well. Why the reason why on both sides we'll see the picture of the kid, regardless of color, you know, with a Bible in his hand or, you know, graduating kindergarten, but he was 21 during the time of the incident.
That's right.
You know, or, you know, the folks going, you know, escorting their mom, you know, instead of wearing some questionable social groups garb that come out in the future. You know, so you just never know. But we really want, it's all about being tribal. You know, like if it's a police case, a lot of times me and Mike could be right on, you know, in most cases. But then it could be one where the offender is, you know, a white man or offender is a black man or whatever the case may be. And then we have to start choosing, okay, well, what really makes sense? Like you said, attach yourself to the 70%, you know, get to the 70 because, you know, we're both going to have ways of looking at things. And we're both, you know, have empathy and compassion for our fellow man, but we don't have a problem killing somebody too.
And usually he's wrong.
You see what I mean?
Well, you know, and that what's funny is, well, you talk about that. There are certain times where we have to make the choice, and there's real consequences, you know. And when you pull the trigger in self defense, that's you're all or nothing. You're all in now, right? And my dog's barking. You might hear that.
No, that's fine.
That's part of my security. You got my home security bolstered up.
Hey, dog.
I didn't want a dog, but my wife convinced me when it was down to security.
Get dogs
a dog.
Are best, right,
I've always said the best security system is a dog.
Yeah.
Whether it be even just a dog that's not like a trained attack dog, but just a dog barking, a live dog. I mean, it's great security.
Hound
system.
Dog with a deep bellow.
Or an ugly wife. That'll help.
Yeah, but anyway, we were talking about
with the baseball bat.
You might be 70% sure, but you have to make a decision that's all or nothing. That's self-defense.
Absolutely.
You know, with a deadly firearm.
Hey, Justin, did you want to jump in as well?
No, I was just going to mention that one of the things, talking about your 70% deal, and I agree with you 1,000% that once somebody takes a stance on an issue or an opinion, it's especially it seems like now with social media, because there's echo chambers created where people feed, you know, people generally associate with people that agree with them on a lot of things. So they reinforce each other. And now the guy's like, well, everybody I know thinks this way, so I know I'm right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But they self-select for their peer group.
Yeah.
So to me, that's interesting.
That's kind of like a 1,000% on the 70%. That's kind of like the 60% of the time it works every time kind of thing.
Yeah, man, I'll take 1,000%.
I'll take 1,000%. They're spot on though. I mean, that's right. You, whoever you associate with, and you, that's the belief system. It's really weird. We're getting into this discussion that is going not probably where we're going to go today, but it's so important, I think, for where we're at right now in society, because everybody's decisions, like I said, I mean, it's just there's already been physical confrontation, shootings, and just really unreasonable things happen just because of masks.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, one of the things, and some of the things I've been writing about now, is when people from two different mindsets mm-hmm. come together. And it might be that somebody's scared late at night and someone's drunk and disoriented, right? Mm-hmm. But it could also be like, I think you're putting my life in danger for not wearing a mask. And mm-hmm. you're like, well, this is all a bunch of overblown nonsense and you're freaking out for nothing and mind your own business, right? And then you put those two together, and if you can't get the folks together on it and you don't talk about it or you don't think about what you have in common, then mm-hmm. things can escalate real fast, mm-hmm. you know? And so many of the self-defense cases we see are people who misunderstand each other. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I mean, a lot of people that I disagree with sort of virulently are also super fun people
yeah.
that I like to yeah. hang out with. Now I'll drink some, I'll brew some brown with them anytime. Right, mm-hmm. Stan?
That's right.
So yeah, it's, so I think as the concealed carrier, I think you have a responsibility that you inherit to be the more understanding one, mm-hmm. right? You can be right and you can be wrong, but like, how important is it to be right?
Yeah.
And how open are your mind, is your mind going to be? Because you're the one that has the power of life or death holstered at your side.
Yeah.
And so you have to be better for both parties.
No, you're right. And it's a huge responsibility. And, you know, it's kind of aligned with how we were in the police department. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that they said in training is that there's always a gun brought to the, you know, to the fight or to the incident. And, you know, and you're the one that has it. Therefore, you have to be more responsible. And the weight of the accountability is heavy on your side because you have the tool of death and destruction, you know, strapped to you. So you have to make decisions as if you don't have that on you and you can't take a life. You know, therefore, would I actually put myself in this position? Would I make this move? Should I pull back and let the person win the verbal confrontation? You know, because most of the time, like we talked about earlier, people just want to win. You know, if you just say, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
if you allow somebody to think that they're winning, who is really the winner? You know, mm-hmm. it's really you, because you don't put yourself in a bad situation. You don't build this thing and escalate it to a point where you have to actually unnecessarily take a life.
And you know, from all the cases we looked at, no matter how the jury decides, everybody's a loser.
That's mm-hmm. right.
Yeah.
You
that's
know,
right.
even when these things go through. Even if you're right, like even if you're 10 years out, that's a choice I'd make. I'd have to make that choice again, mm-hmm. but you still regret that situation ever happening. You know, everyone's lives turned upside down, so there is no winner. There's just various levels of losing.
Correct. You know, like when we had a chance to individually have talks with Stephen Maddox, and you know, he's okay with us talking about this, but you know. Even, you know, years later, he'll still second guess his thoughts, you know, about, you know, was it worth changing my life? Was it worth losing my job, losing my family, and having to fight for all this stuff back? You know, credibility, you know, the fact that, you know, we were forced to, you know, do apply a legal team for an expungement of the charge and try to clean up as much as we can on a Google search for him. I mean, that matters when you're looking for a job. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you think about that, and it's like, wow, you know, what should I have done? And that kind of pulls us back into the original topic, which is learning from the mistakes of others and gaining as much knowledge as we can. And that's why we hire you to give that information to our audience. So let's kind of jump right into how do you and Don decide to come up with, okay, what are the elements that are consistent with all these cases across the board? And these are the ones that we're going to write about, and this is how we're going to separate it. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, a lot of the cases, if you want to go out there and look for, you know, a home defender kills a criminal and wasn't charged, there's lots of those out there, right? Mm. And there's lots of cases where it's pretty clear when a firearm was involved, and everything's cut and dried, and those are fun to read, and they kind of support how we feel about self-defense, and they justify the investment that we've made. But what we're concerned about is, you know, what if you're wrong about a couple of things? What if you misperceive something? What if you thought they were armed, but they're not armed? And where are the cases where we got somebody who we feel was generally a law-abiding citizen with good intentions who took someone's life, maybe had legitimate fear, but made mistakes that made them fight for their, you know, you call that the second fight, right? Mm-hmm. Fight for their freedom. And so when we see those, they tend to be very controversial cases, but they have the best lessons. So that's what we're looking for. You talked about the elements. The things that we see, there's certain things that exist no matter what in every case. And that is, one is where a shooting happens is very important legally and tactically, right? So if you're in your home, you have a castle doctrine and a certain set of standards that might change a little bit if you're just outside your home, you know, or on the curtilage of your property. That changes if now you're out on the street. Mm-hmm. It matters if you're in front of someone else's house or your house, right? It matters if you're in a bar or a public place or someplace you're not legally allowed to be. All that, you know, in your car, we have a lot of road rage instances. The dynamics change. So every shooting happens somewhere. We often like to take a look at that location and see what can we pull out of there. Mm-hmm. Two is almost never do you have a case that just goes 0 to 100% in a split second. There's some escalation that happens, right? There's an event that initiates the conflict, right? And then there's a at least a couple of decisions before the decision to pull the trigger that lead up to this inevitable encounter. And so we'd like to look at what things did both parties do to either escalate or try to de-escalate the confrontation before the shooting happens, right? From a legal standard, super important is the idea of reasonable fear, right? And so you're the almost every self-defense statute that I can have ever encountered says that use of deadly force is justified only if you have a reasonable fear of imminent great bodily harm or death. Imminent means right now, but then reasonable fear, that's so subjective. Right? And so what are the elements that constitute reasonable fear, and what is reasonable, what's not reasonable? That exists. And often we'll put that in the perspective of a continuum, because I think it's really natural if someone's broken into your house for you to be afraid, but also to be angry at the same time. Right? And so we've seen cases where it strayed past fear to revenge, you know, up in Oklahoma City, the Jerome Ersling case. He shot that first kid the first time. It was justified. He was holding up the place. It was an armed robbery. But then after that kid's incapacitated and he leaves, comes back, gets another gun to shoot him again to kill him, right? That's a clear cross the line. So anyway, so reasonable fear is the third element. And then finally, we like to talk about post-incident actions. And I think that's some of the most, you know, practical conversation we can have, because if you're involved in the shooting, you need, if you can, to be the one to report it or have someone call and report it.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, if the other person, if one of their friends or if they survived it and they called 911 first, you're on the backside of this conversation all of a sudden, right?
Yes.
But then you don't want to say too much to the law enforcement, because you guys know from use of force incidents, you're not in your right mind for a day or two.
Yeah.
Right? You may, even Maddox, who encourages us to talk about his case, he got things wrong, like about how many kids he had and where he lived.
That's right. That's right.
He, he wasn't trying to lie.
No.
He was just so shaken up.
Yes.
And Don West, he'll tell you as a criminal defense attorney that the hardest facts to overcome in the case are the misstatements that defender say to the police. And so what you do immediately following a self-defense shooting will have huge ramifications on how that shooting scene and what your legal defense is going to look like.
I've had a conversation with Don, and this is something I see over and over again in your articles and other things that I pay attention to. And that is that speaking to what you're talking about, having to overcome initial early statements later on down the line in trial, you know, a guy says something or it's taken the wrong way, or, you know, like Stephen Maddox during his initial interrogation, what was it? He didn't remember how old his kids were or something like that.
He didn't remember how many he had.
Yeah, how many kids he had. I mean,
where they, went to school.
Yeah, went all to school,
Yeah, so, I mean, stuff like that gets said when you're under duress, you know, there's a reason why most police departments, after a critical incident, 2-3 days sleep cycles before they make a statement.
Yeah.
You know, it's
hey, and you know what's interesting about what you're saying too, Justin, you know, coming from the way we thought as policemen, there's also a difference between your first line responder, meaning the initial officer, and the investigator. Investigators, most of them, not all of them either, you know, they not only have their experience and they have different schooling that they might go to in reference to techniques and such and how people react and respond about human nature that regular cops, especially younger ones, just don't know. So if you make a misstep in reference to what you say to me, then I've already, you know, branded you as a liar, and anything you say after that is going to be held against you in my court of my head, right? So it's kind of like whatever you say, I mean, anything you say that's in favor of your defense, I might omit that, and that happens often.
Oh, it happens. Yeah, we've seen it happen in cases personally where people get so locked into one thing that they either omit other facts or they find some reason, like Sean and Justin were both talking about earlier, that they might find something just to omit that because it's not what they they may be aligned with, you know, some other thought process. And I think especially when you hit it on the head when talking about investigators, especially in larger cities, have a lot more training.
That's right.
Than, you know, smaller municipalities. So you get into the size of the department, the budget of the department, you know, how much training is available.
Yeah, because like in, you know, our other partner, Kyle Sweet, in his department at Enid, the patrol officer also does the investigations all the way up. Now, that could be good, that could be bad, right? And if they don't have enough funds to actually, you know, have, you know, learn and go to schools and know how to do that, then it's just on the job training, which is not always good, especially if you just suck as an investigator. And you'll
run
into
those. Or if you got
a
bad trainer.
You can have that too.
We've all had
some
bad trainers.
You can have that too. You're right about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and it's, I think a lot of folks feel like they're justified and that if they can explain themselves to the cops, that they're going to be all right. You know, and so they get a little overboard explaining things and they confabulate and they fill in a couple of details or they get something wrong because they just didn't perceive it properly.
Yes.
They're emotionally distressed. They don't realize it yet. And then just start causing real trouble. So you know, Don West always talks about, you know, be cooperative, point them to evidence that you think is important.
Yes.
Right. But you guys, cops, you know, if someone says, listen, I understand the gravity of what happened here and I'm shooken up. And I really just want, I think it's best I'm going to get someone to represent me and we'll talk when the time's right.
Yeah.
You know, I'll cooperate with you now. And one thing I like to stress is I feel like if you've shot somebody and they're dead, you've committed a homicide, whether or not it's justified, right?
That's right.
It's serious. If I've resolved that if that happens to me, I'm resolved that I'm going to jail that night. Right? Like, don't try to talk yourself out of going to jail tonight. Yeah. At the risk of going to prison for the rest of your life.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. So you'd be like, listen, you know, if you're going to take me in, like, because they might try to pressure you.
Yeah.
Like, hey, if you just help us clear up a few things, we can get you out of here. Right.
Yeah.
No. Officer, I understand. I understand what's the gravity of this. I know how to, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And then you're right. And that, too, is kind of a police trick. You know, we want to. I mean, and I say trick. Like, excuse me. I got to be careful what I say, because we absolutely love policemen. But it does help you to gather the information needed, right? So you're going to try to, you know, make it so that, you know, because we used to do it sometimes with, now you do with women. Now, you know, you want to be home with your kids, right? You know, it's one of those. So you plant the seed of you might be going away from your children. We're going to take your kids away or something like that. That's going to help them to talk. Kind of tricky, but it gets done what you need. But in most cases.
You can flat out lie.
Oh, absolutely. Oh,
we have a video. We saw it.
That's right.
And oh, you do? Okay, well, then you know this. Right?
You know. But you know what's funny about that? You know, prior to us having a lot of technology around here, because we had just got our computers in the cars. They're called the MDTs, right?
Yeah.
So we just got our MDTs in the car. Well, we weren't even familiar with them. But because no one else was familiar with them, I used to do this thing where I would put some God.
I don't know if fingerprint. We want to talk
no, this
about
is fine. This is just to gather information. Just to gather information, right? Because you know you can play with certain buttons and it'll make the thing ding or whatever. So I would put some stuff on and I put their hand against the. And I said, have you seen this new technology? I said, boy, it tells me every time who a person is. And I put their hand against the screen and I make it do something. And I have something set to say, you know, the person's not being truthful. So it's almost like a lie detector test I created, but it worked for me. Mike, there's nothing wrong with this. I never put any money in jail for it. I'm okay. And I've been gone for over 7 years. Shut up.
Yeah, I don't even think you get that charge thrown out.
No, you really can't. But you know, but the thing about it, why I'm saying that, you know, officers will come up with different things, you know, to like get you to say certain things or to give you the entire story. And most patrolmen, they just want to go home. They don't really care about you. They want to know that this is just another call for them. They want to know what's the fact so I can give it to the investigator and then close out my little supplemental. But the problem is everything that you say in that first interaction with law enforcement gets locked in. And then when you really realize what the true story was and what you saw, your lawyer is telling the story, right?
And
that was the problem because it looks like you lied in the beginning.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so as hard as it is, you just gotta shut up, be cooperative, but you know you gotta get Gary on his way. That's what you gotta do.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that nowadays, like when we were on the street, it was a lot different than it is now. I think nowadays most police officers understand this as well because of all the police shootings have increased.
It's been high profile. Right.
Yeah, and I think that police officers are even like, well, I'm not going to talk to him until I talk with the FOP rep or the PBA rep or whatever. So I think, you know, you can tell, you know, responding officers, hey, man, I want to cooperate with you. I want to do everything I can to help you do your job. I don't really feel comfortable right now. I'm shooken up. And they're going to understand that more. I think than when we, because as we, you know, when we were officers, I mean, we understood, we got some training on the physiological effects and stuff like that, but not as they do now.
Correct.
I mean, training's gotten better over the time.
It really has.
They understand that more. So, you know, you can do it in a way other than by saying, I'm not talking to you. I'm not giving you any information.
Don't flip them
turn.
Off.
Yeah, I mean, there's a way that you can do it, and I think they accept that easier
absolutely.
Today. And they're not going to have you put your hand on a button.
No, they're not going to put your hand on the screen no more.
That's a great scene from The Wire. They used a copy machine.
Yeah. What we did on the part of town that I worked on was we just had recorders in the back seat.
Well, of course, we had those as well.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, we're looking for these lessons, Stan. I think probably the biggest lesson that I've taken away from here is in practically every circumstance, there's a decision that the defender could have made.
Yes.
Yeah.
That would have avoided the deadly confrontation, right? Whether it's don't open the door to see who's outside.
Correct.
Or whether it's don't get out of the car.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Or you know, call 911 and wait in your room instead of going out into the living room. You know, and it's tough. Some of that goes against sort of like our human nature, especially a lot of us are men. Let's face it, right? And we've got that sort of instinct,
protecting,
the defensive instinct. Yeah, I've come across a couple cases where if the people had just taken their wife's advice, like the whole thing's
that's hilarious.
but you're probably right.
We just heard the Charles Dorsey case where the guy was at the wrong house and trying to get in.
Yeah.
You're right. You can hear on the recording, the wife's like, don't go outside. Don't go outside.
Yeah.
You know, that if he had gone outside, he may have been arrested and he waited for the guy to get in and then he shot him and he was justified. You know, we just talked about the Alexander Weiss case. And here's a guy who got in a car accident. The other guy's getting real aggressive towards him. He says, I should call the cops. He says, if you call the cops, I'm going to kill you. So he goes back to his car, which is still running. And he gets his cell phone and he gets his gun and then goes back to talk to the guy. Right? And that's any moment as a concealed carrier, you find yourself like, oh, I'm going to get the gun now.
Yeah.
Especially if you're not carrying it on you, but if you're a gun owner and you're like, oh, I'm going to go to my glove box and get the gun because I might need it.
Yeah.
Like, that's the alarm. If you have that thought, it's like, okay, what else can I do? Even if it doesn't make me feel good as a man, that would keep me from having to shoot this guy, because we know already, even if you win that fight, even if you win the second fight, everyone's a loser. You know, those are the biggest lessons that I've gotten from these cases.
You said something in that article that really stuck with me, speaking about the Weiss case, and that is, don't go back to the fight. So if you're able to get away and have a means of egress somewhere you can get away to, especially like in a road rage incident or something like that, it's different if somebody comes in your home. But, you know, if you have a means to just get out of that situation, do not go back to it. Unless you got to go back for a family member or something like that, or if you don't have to go back, go get out.
Well, and that's,
well, how do you explain to a jury that your fear was reasonable? That you thought you were in immediate fear,
but you go back
again. You went back to the danger. It doesn't lie. Yeah.
Well, we were talking about, so one thing, and Stan and I can both talk about this, but, and we talk about, you know, well, we're men, we're kind of, you know, fundamental basic protectors, or we want to be, we want to solve something, we want to get involved. And people tend to, with firearm, get more involved. But we've talked about police officers, and I know plenty of police officers who I would go through any door with. They're badass officers.
Right.
And they do not get involved in stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've talked with Pat McNamara talking about, you know, and Larry Vickers and these Delta Force guys. The first thing they're going to do is get out of that situation. And police officers, we talked about lying earlier too. And yes, police officers can lie when they're interviewing to suspects or whatever. But there are a lot of times when, I mean, I remember several instances where I would, you know, lie to somebody just to get them, you know, patted down and in my back seat as fast as I could, because I know if I push this or if I let it go longer, this was going to be a fight. PCP. I mean,
oh my God.
I remember coming up on guys stripping down in the middle of the street going crazy.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh man, I'm on my way to breakfast or my dinner, man. I don't got time for this. Can I just get your information right quick? And while you're saying that, you're patting them down real quick and putting them in your car. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, okay, good. I got them in the car.
Yeah.
So that no fight. Now I can get somebody over here to help me, because it's going to be a fight.
Yeah.
Once we have to handcuff this guy. And people think, I think people who don't have that experience, or, you know, maybe not know police officers. I mean, police officers deal with this stuff every day.
Yes.
They're working. They can read, and we've talked about this before too. Police officers have, they don't have better intuition than other people, but they have better trusted intuition from other people, because they have more experience.
That's right.
Using that intuition and finding out, yep, that's right, I was right. If I would have done this, that would have happened. Mm-hmm. And other people don't have that.
Correct.
And so for somebody to think, well, I've got this firearm and I should get involved, they really should. I mean, the mindset of a badass police officer, you know, who initiates his own activity and kicks ass on the street, when they get into these certain situations, they're looking for the quickest way to end it. And we've talked about how many times could you have shot somebody that you didn't.
So
people really should think about that, that, you know, and a lot of people think that they want to be like, you know, that they have a firearm now and they want to think like that. But it's really kind of counteractive thinking to what real officers out on the street are, because they're trying to control that situation. And once they get that control, they lock that control down and they don't go back to a fight.
And to piggyback Mike's thought, you know, one of the things that police officers also do is, you know, we learn from each other, because at the end of the night, people are telling their stories. And we learn that, you know, when you hear a story from another officer that's been through something that particular day, you go, okay, you know, if I would have done this. And sometimes he'll say, you know, I shouldn't have done this, you know, because we had a lot of officers sometimes that would, and we would identify that, they pat somebody down, they find some drugs, and they put it on on the hood. Well, and then they continue to pat them down versus handcuffing them.
Yeah.
Every single time, bar none, there's going to be a chase or they're gonna try to, you know, eat the dope. Yeah, they'll eat the dope, and then there's a fight. Yeah. So a fight comes out of that, and then you learn, okay, you find it, leave it where it is. You know what it is.
You don't even need to pull it out.
You don't have to pull it out.
Handcuff them, and
then pull, right? Or sometimes, like Mike said, I mean, there's been a few cases, because there's not too many that we run into in the field, but there are some that their motivation is to cause harm to you. Mm-hmm. That when you run into, and you know, although pretty tough guys, but it's like, I need to put this one up. I need to. So you talk them in, you sweet talk them into the car. Yeah. Not that we're not down with fighting, but you really don't want to in certain cases when you know somebody is. You got to pick your battles, because it's all about winning. So you're playing chess at the same time, and you're not allowing your ego to outweigh your common sense. And that's what happens with concealed carriers at times. They do that. It's like, I got the gun now. So they have this inflated ego, and they're making bad decisions because it's like, you know, I can take your life, but do you want to?
Yeah, and, you know, police officers are trained to handle those situations, right? And that's part of their job. We ask, this is why I'm usually super sympathetic, even when police officers make mistakes when it comes to these shootings, because we're asking them to put themselves in danger to resolve a scary incident, right? Mm-hmm. And but the average citizen does not have to do that. Mm-hmm. And so we talk about being a good witness. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of times where you could intervene with a gun, but you're taking on a huge amount of risk and opening up the door to a life and death situation, when instead get on the phone with 911.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Be a good witness. That's a better way to help than to get involved yourself.
And that's when we came up with the citizens' use of force
continuum,
because that is right. I mean, you have to avoid at all costs, and most of the time, it is better to have a better report than to get involved.
Yeah, to be a good witness instead of being an involved person, because you know something about that, especially after you call, because there's two mistakes: you don't call 911 and you involve yourself, and then you do call 911 and you continue the pursuit. Instead of, especially back in the day in the 90s before we had all the camera phones and stuff, you would have to kind of rely on your memory. Okay, did he wear a green shirt? Was it like red shoes? Nowadays, you can take a picture of the person, blow it up. You got all the stuff you need. You've given them the stuff that they need. Stop trying to be the police. And that's a lot of, you know, like these current cases that we're dealing with right now, the citizen cases, a lot of times they go too far. Stop trying to make citizens' arrests on stuff where people are taking property, or in a nonviolent incident doesn't concern you and your family. If it's a violent incident, you got to make the decision. Mm-hmm. But if it's not a violent incident, stay your butt where you are. Give the people that are supposed to, like Sean said, that get paid to be in danger. That's their job. Let them do their job. Just because you have a gun, that doesn't make you a cop, and don't be that way.
Yeah, man. That's a recipe for disaster.
One thing that we talk about a lot is visualization and thinking about, if you think about something and you visualize it, the situation, whatever, you're more likely, if that situation arises, not to be vapor locked and thinking, I'm taking this all in. I've never thought about this before. What do I do? And there's a couple of firearms trainers that talk about this as well. And that is, you know, beforehand, actually sit and think, what would be required for me to get involved? Like, what am I going to walk away from? And then, you know, what is that line to where I'm willing to risk my freedom and my life to step over that to get involved with potential deadly force? And that's going to be different for everyone. But as long as you think about the actual real ramifications of what can happen once you make that decision to get engaged, I mean, you are putting your life and freedom on the line when you step into that situation. So for me, and I've told my friends this, like, especially now during COVID with lots of new gun owners, I've got a couple of my friends, I tell them, I was like, look, you really have to think about this.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's the realest thing in the world. Like, the decision you make can impact you and your family's lives forever. So you better think about it. And like I said, it's different for everyone, but as long as they think about it, I think that's the first step.
I agree. And I think with visualization, and we do talk about that a lot, and I think it's hugely important. And with visualization, you have to be careful, because I used to fall asleep going through houses, raids in houses, because I was running warrants. We were doing entries 3, 4, 5 times a week. when I was working in Impact. And so I would fall asleep going through these, and there's two things that happen, and it's just human nature. Your mind will build your scenario more complex and more complex and more complex, and it will make it unwinnable.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be careful of that.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times when I always thought of it as a like a cassette tape. You play it, and you don't do this anymore with iTunes movies or even DVDs, but you rewind. And there would be times when I get to points in my mind where I would have to stop and I'd have to rewind back to not make it as complex. The second thing is you always have to remember that every scenario that you present doesn't have to be met with force. Every scenario doesn't have to be met with a firearm. Every scenario doesn't have to be met with a interjection of yourself into this.
Mm-hmm.
So like Justin was saying, if you have a clear idea of what would cause me to do this and what wouldn't cause me to do that,
mm-hmm.
also think about mental imagery and visualization of what you would do in a situation if you didn't have interject yourself into it.
Yeah.
What would you do in a situation? What would you get? Tag numbers?
Yes.
Would you get the car descriptions?
Yes.
Would you try to get the best physical descriptions of the person? Would you try to get video? Would you try to get photo? Because I know how hard it is to get photo and video. You know, you get your camera out. Oh, shit. You swipe up and, oh, dang it. It's not working. I have to put my code in. So you have to think about these things. So that's actually a good point to think about of if it's not meeting this,
that's
what
right.
am I going
to
do?
And, you know, just to piggyback Mike's thought, you know, a good tool that you can use is something that we already give you guys, and that is who doesn't have our members, that is, you know, the Citizens Use of Force Continuum. You know, you could use that tool and say, you know, okay, so tonight I'm going to go through a scenario with my the bank that I go to all the time or whatever, the 7-Eleven I go to all the time, and in this particular one I'm going to, you know, really work through in my mind before I go to sleep, you know, how to de-escalate if I run into a situation. And then you go to the next step. So, okay, the next tool is, okay, avoidance and, you know, and then keep going on, you know. So avoidance, de-escalation, you know, it being escalated, you know, and each time figure out a way for you to step out of that situation. Yeah, to sidestep it, right, to avoidance, like which Mike has created this thing to do so. And then all the way, build it all the way up to deadly force when you have to use force. And like Justin said, you know, start working on, okay, I'm by myself. The next one, now with my son. The next one, I'm with my wife. The next one, you know, and just kind of keep working on that and practice these things and utilize the continuum along with some of these articles that Sean and Don write, and then work through. You don't have to keep making them up. Use the scenarios that they give you in the articles to work through the tools that we give you.
Yeah. And that's where
I can bring it full circle, Stan, like it made me think of, remember that one member, they did it anonymously, but they sent in, they lived on that ranch in California.
Yep. Yeah.
And they, late at night, this guy, shirtless, shoeless, bloodied, wearing blue jeans, on his porch, demanding to be let in, banging on the door, trying to use the porch swing as a ramrod.
Yes.
Pulling bushes out. And I remember he wrote in that email that he remembered the Ted Wafer story.
Yep. That's right.
About, and the lesson was... Don't open the door.
Yes.
Don't go outside.
Yes.
And so he got his wife in a safe place in the house with the kids. She called 911. He was rural, so it took him like 20 minutes to get out there. This guy was raging in his yard for 20 minutes, and he had a face-to-face encounter with him over a window.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
And he said, if you break in, I'm going to shoot you.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, the cops got there. They brought him down. No one was shot. That man didn't have to explain to his kids why he shot somebody on their porch that night.
That's right.
And that he had in mind one of the articles that we had written.
Yeah.
And he had visualized that scenario, and it may have affected the outcome. And that's what I got into.
And it absolutely did, you know, because and we get those often, you know, probably about once a week, you know, we'll have an incident that someone will share with us about, you know, they de-escalated because they read your articles. And that's more, you know, us having these discussions are really, really helpful. The podcasts are amazing when you gather little nuggets. You don't have to believe or, you know, attach everything that we say. But we give a lot of good nuggets and tips that you guys should take away with you and pick and choose, cherry pick what you like out of these. But the same thing with the articles. Utilize these things, you know, because we've had these experiences and you have not. So you learn from the people that have had good experiences and bad experiences, and you take the good out of all of these things and polish your decision making is really what this is all about.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's a great point. So I think we're going on good time. We probably need to – you want to do key takeaways?
Yeah.
I get a start.
You get to start. Go ahead.
My key takeaway is do not get pulled over by Stan in the wrong neighborhood, because you might have to put your palm up on the screen of his MDT.
I'm going to lie to you. I'm going to lie to you. Say I got you.
Do you have the little gel like what they do, ultrasound? You put it on their hand, smear it around, tell them to put it up there?
Yeah. That's not – what's your real takeaway? You don't really – come on, stop. Don't do that.
You know, my takeaway is that what he said at the very end, these stories that they've been doing, that's why I say they're meat and potatoes, what we do. Mm. These stories are perfect examples to put yourself into and kind of go through and understand what happened to these people, and to just be aware and read these stories and get on the newsletter list, because even though these are happening to other people, you might find yourself in a similar situation, like mm-hmm. the guy out in California. And that was an awesome email to get from that guy, because I remember he had this face-to-face at the back of his house, and he was inside, and he said he was scared shitless.
Yeah.
And this guy was looking at him, you know, through the window, like, I'm coming in. And he was, you know, but he kept his cool the whole time because of the Ted Wafer case. So that'd be my key takeaway. And not to get pulled over by Stan.
Shut up. And then mine, of course, you know, I'm going to stick to, and hopefully we can get Justin to attach the citizens' use of force continuum.
Yep.
Utilize the tools that not only, you know, that we give, you know, people like Andrew Branca, Don West, Sean Vincent. Utilize these takeaways and these tools to keep you from launching yourself into a deadly force incident that you shouldn't be in. So that's my takeaway.
Mine is, I think the articles that Sean and Don do together, Sean does more of them, probably the most valuable content we put out,
mm-hmm.
because you're able to get the knowledge and experience of so many of these people that have went through this, and a lot of them have changed their lives and maybe in prison for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he's able to distill it down and also write it in a way to where, you know, you want to find out what
mm-hmm.
happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And put all the facts in there, and whenever you're able to learn from somebody else's mistakes, that's extremely valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see anyone else out here doing the stuff like he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell everyone, like, if you're a concealed carrier and it is kind of a lifestyle, like mm-hmm. if you're going to live your life with that as a part of it, you know, you're doing yourself a disservice if you don't read this stuff, because it doesn't cost anything, and you're getting a tremendous amount of knowledge about what really happens.
That's right.
It's not opinions. It's not, this is what I think will happen. It happened.
Yes.
Like, there's either someone in prison or not.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, and you can see what put them there.
Yes.
And so to me, that's the biggest takeaway. I don't think you can overstate the value of this stuff.
That's right. And Sean, you're up.
Well, that's nice. I really appreciate the feedback, guys, because the longer I've done them, the more I enjoy doing them. And the more depth and nuance I can find in these different scenarios. So my takeaway would be, I had a really good one a second ago, but I forgot about it now. It's you know what, I've looked for in my personal life more and more things that I can do that would avoid confrontation, you know, and it's like I'm more concerned about potential invaders now that the economy is tanking and we're having, you know, I don't know what things would be like, all these people unemployed,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I made an investment in, I enhanced my security system. I got more lights on my yard. I got more automation. I know how to use those tools more. You know, anything I can do to make my house less attractive, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You talk about the situational awareness to bring this full circle. You know, my situational awareness is higher, and, yeah, I'm just becoming more alert, aware, person since I've been writing these articles for you guys. And that's kept me out of trouble, I'm pretty sure.
Nice. You know, one thing he said, I'm a quote guy, so I'm going to end this with this quote, because this quote, I talked to my daughter about this quote recently, because it really hits home with this coronavirus, but also like going through a divorce personally, but even with this type of stuff. Crisis doesn't build character, it reveals it.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So be the person you are in crisis, and be the person you want to be and need to be for your legal, physical, legal, and emotional, mental survival in one of these things. All right.
Thanks, Sean.
Thanks, Sean. Out there. Great to have you on. Y'all guys be safe.